Every brand strategist knows Acre, Keller, and Capfer. These frameworks shape the field. But here's what none of them can tell you: how much to invest in each dimension of your brand, for which audience, and what happens if you get it wrong. That gap has been open for 30 years.
Right, it's a massive blind spot.
We're going to cover four things. First, how SBT connects to the frameworks you already use. It extends them, doesn't replace them. Second, why brand consistency isn't one thing. There are five structurally different types. Third, the dark signal, how Hermes makes billions by not communicating. And fourth, how you can run this analysis on Monday morning with open source tools.
Yeah, and our mission for this deep dive is to basically give you a shortcut to mastering spectral brand theory, or SBT for short, because for decades, brand management has relied heavily on, qualitative judgment, gut feeling.
Lots of gut feeling in those strategy rooms.
Exactly. So we are going to show you how to measure what was previously just gut feeling. By the end of this conversation, you will be armed with the vocabulary to explain exactly why certain brands survive massive crises while others just, they shatter under the pressure.
And I think it's important to clarify right off the bat, we are not throwing away the classic playbooks here.
No, definitely not.
If you've built your career on, say, David Acre's brand identity model, your knowledge is still completely valid. The way I like to think about the relationship between Acre's model and spectral brand theory is it's like the relationship between classical economics and behavioral
Well,
economics.
that's a really good analogy.
Right, because classical economics gives you this beautiful, elegant theory of how rational markets should behave in a perfect world.
Where everyone makes perfectly logical decisions.
Exactly. But then behavioral economics comes along, adds the complex math, the psychology, and the absolute heterogeneity of real messy humans to show you how things actually behave in reality. And SBT essentially does that for branding.
It really does. And to see how that behavioral translation works, I want you to picture a specific side-by-side visual.
Okay, painting a picture here.
Yeah, so on the left side, you have Acre's four classic boxes. You've got brand as product, brand as organization, brand as person, and brand as symbol. It's totally foundational.
The classic four.
Right. Now, on the right side, I want you to picture that exact same brand, but it's mapped onto eight SBT spectral axes.
Okay, so we're doubling the resolution here. What are the eight?
They are the semiotic, narrative, ideological, experiential, social, economic, cultural, and temporal dimensions.
Wait, before we start mapping a brand across all of those, we should probably unpack what those eight axes actually measure. I mean, the difference between semiotic and ideological isn't immediately obvious, especially if you're used to just thinking about like brand as symbol.
Yeah, let's break them down quickly. So the semiotic axis measures the pure sensory signals, that's your logo, the specific weight of the glass bottle you use, the UI of your
The
app.
tangible stuff.
Exactly. The narrative is the literal story you tell about who you are. The ideological axis measures your worldview and values. Experiential is the pure functional utility, like does the
Yeah.
product actually work?
Does it do the thing you bought it for?
Right. Then social measures the status the brand grants the user among their peers. Economic is the perceived accessibility and price structure. Cultural measures your connection to the broader shifting zeitgeist. And finally, temporal measures your heritage and your perceived trajectory into the future.
So you're taking those four classic buckets and just unbundling them into a much higher resolution.
Unbundling them is the only way to see the underlying architecture. Take Acre's brand as person box, for example.
Okay.
Under SBT, that single concept of a brand's personality is unbundled into three separately scored dimensions: narrative, ideological, and cultural. And this visual exercise shows us why that matters so much.
Because they can conflict.
Exactly. Those three dimensions can move in entirely opposite directions. A brand might have a highly appealing cultural aesthetic, they use the right influencers, the right music, but they might hold a completely contradictory ideological stance that angers that exact same demographic.
Wow, yeah.
If you just score a unified brand as person, you average those forces out. You completely hide the internal contradiction.
And that totally changes how we think about the target audience, right? Because instead of saying we're targeting affluent millennials in urban centers, which, let's be honest, tells you almost nothing about what those people actually believe or value, you're grouping people by how they process these specific signals.
That's the core insight of the theory right there.
Yeah.
SBT treats brand as an engineering problem. We don't use demographic audiences anymore. We look at perceptual cohorts.
Perceptual cohorts. Unpack that for me.
A perceptual cohort is a group of people who process brand signals through a similar structural filter. You might have, say, a 25-year-old barista and a 55-year-old investment banker in the exact same cohort.
Because on paper, they look nothing alike.
Right. Demographically, they're opposites. But they might both heavily weigh a brand's ideological and narrative dimensions while completely ignoring the economic dimension. When you stop looking at demographics and start looking at how human minds actually filter information, the mathematics of branding finally start to work.
It's like Acre gave you the map. SBT adds coordinates.
Yes. Perfectly said.
Oh.
But that brings us to a very, very dangerous trap.
Uh-oh. The boardroom trap.
The boardroom trap. Because now that we have these highly specific coordinates across eight dimensions, executives inevitably try to collapse them back down into a single brand health score for a quarterly dashboard.
Well, yeah, because the board wants to see a single number going up. They want to know that the brand equity score is a 78 out of 100, and hey, last quarter it was a 76, so we're doing great.
Right, but if you take eight diverging dimensions and average them into a 78, you're mathematically annihilating the actual data.
So a 78 tells you nothing.
Worse than nothing, it's misleading. This is what SBT calls the metamerism problem. It's actually a concept borrowed directly from color science.
Okay, color science. How does that fit?
So in optics, metamerism happens when two completely different light sources have vastly different physical wavelengths, right? But they happen to look like the exact same color to the human eye under certain lighting.
Oh, because our eyes just kind of mash the data together?
Exactly. The human eye compresses all that complex, rich spectral data down to just three receptors. And in that biological compression, the physical differences are entirely lost.
So in the boardroom, you have a dashboard telling the CMO that two competitors both have a brand score of 78. And traditional analysis dictates that they are equals. They occupy the same tier in the market.
But SBP proves this is a mathematical illusion. A single score hides massive structural differences.
Like, give me an example of how that plays out.
Well, you could have a luxury brand with towering scores in temporal heritage and cultural resonance, but a massive, deliberate valley in economic accessibility. And that averages out to a 78. Then you have a mass market brand, completely dominated by economic accessibility and experiential utility, with absolute zero heritage. It also scores a 78. A single number makes an elephant and a cheetah look identical simply because they happen to weigh the same.
That is a wild way to look at it. But wait, if that 78 out of 100 score is an illusion, it makes me really question the fundamental metrics we use to get there. Usually those unified scores highly reward the concept of brand consistency.
Oh, definitely.
Right. This idea that you have to say the exact same thing in the exact same tone across every single channel. Is SBT arguing that consistency is actually a bad thing?
Yes, essentially. The assumption that unified consistency is always good is exactly what gets brands killed in a crisis.
Wait, really? Because that goes against every branding textbook out there.
I know, but consistency is not a single variable. It is right. Not a volume dial you just turn from low to high. There are five structurally different types of coherence. And depending on which type your brand utilizes, you will either survive a market disruption or you will be destroyed by it.
Okay, let's walk through these five architectures then. If I'm looking at a brand that does practice that traditional unified consistency, what does that look like structurally?
That is the first type, signal coherence. Think of a brand like IKEA. We would grade their architecture an A.
Because they're incredibly consistent.
Right. Everyone who interacts with IKEA sees the exact same consistent signals across all eight dimensions. The democratic design, the blue and yellow semiotics, the flat pack experiential utility. It is incredibly unified. But here's the vulnerability. Under a crisis, the disruption transmits uniformly everywhere.
Oh, I see. So IKEA is vulnerable precisely because their armor is completely uniform. If there's like a massive global supply chain failure or a sudden spike in timber prices, every single cohort feels the exact same shock because they all rely on the exact same utility signals.
Exactly. There is no structural defense to absorb the blow.
So is there a way to build a brand where the armor is designed to repel specific attacks rather than absorb all of them?
Yes, and that is the second type, identity coherence. Think of Patagonia, grading it a B+.
Okay, Patagonia.
This architecture relies on an ideological filter. Patagonia's deep, vocal environmental values act as a mechanism that actively repels misaligned cohorts and fiercely attracts aligned ones.
And just to be clear for you listening, we're observing this purely objectively as a structural mechanism. We're not endorsing any specific political stance here. The physics of it are what matter.
Exactly. It's just about the structural physics. When Patagonia tells customers, "Don't buy this jacket," to protest overconsumption, they intentionally lose the fast fashion buyer. But in doing so, the hardcore outdoorsman's loyalty becomes basically bulletproof.
So the rejection is the actual engine of the attraction. The filter strengthens the core believers while pushing the skeptics further away. But what happens if you have a brand where the different observer groups don't even care about the same things at all?
What do you mean?
Like, say, a brand where one group is buying it for the pure utility and another group is buying it purely for the status. Did they just ignore each other?
They don't ignore each other. They actually rely on each other. This is the third type, ecosystem coherence. And honestly, it is the holy grail of brand architecture. Think of Hermes grading it an A-plus mine.
The holy grail. Okay, how does Hermes pull this off?
In an ecosystem, different observer cohorts perceive entirely different things about the brand, but those differences functionally reinforce one another.
Give me an example.
So financial investors look at Hermes and see brilliant economic scarcity. Wealthy heritage collectors look at the temporal dimension and see centuries of craftsmanship. Aspirational buyers look at the social dimension and see ultimate status.
So Hermes is essentially using the aspirational buyer to fund the ecosystem, while the heritage collector gives it legitimacy.
Yes.
They are structurally dependent on each other, even though they never interact, and they value completely different signals. That's fascinating.
Precisely. The aspirational buyer's desire creates the massive cultural heat, which validates the investor's thesis on scarcity, which in turn protects the exclusivity that the heritage collector demands.
It's a closed loop.
It is. And when a crisis hits, this ecosystem absorbs the disruption by sacrificing the periphery to protect the core. If a massive economic downturn happens, the aspirational buyers might get priced out and fall away. But the heritage collectors will double down, stabilizing the entire system.
Wow. Okay, so these first three types, signal, identity, and ecosystem, all seem to rely on a physical product or a direct interaction. Does this coherence change when the brand is mostly experienced digitally or, you know, from a distance?
It does, and that creates the fourth type, experiential asymmetry. Think of Erewhon, the hyper-expensive grocery store in Los Angeles we graded a B.
Oh, man, Erewhon.
Yeah, this architecture thrives on a massive geographic and access gap. You have direct observers, the people actually standing in the store buying a $20 smoothie, and mediated observers, the millions of people watching TikTok reviews about it.
Right, because most people have never actually stepped foot in an Erewhon.
Exactly. The direct observer gets the semiotic and experiential reality. The mediated observer gets the cultural and social signal. The brand's entire cultural heat exists in the tension between the physical reality and the digital projection.
That makes total sense. And the final type?
The fifth type is incoherent. Think of Tesla right now, grading it a C.
Incoherent? That sounds bad.
Well, it means strong, but wildly contradictory signals produce irreconcilable perception clouds. The physical product experience signals futuristic clean energy and engineering. But the CEO's ambient behavior signals something entirely different.
Oh, right.
When disruption hits an incoherent brand, it doesn't just transmit the shock. It aggressively widens the existing cracks between those perception clouds.
Okay, so if I'm a CMO sitting in a room on Monday morning looking at a dashboard, how does knowing about, say, ecosystem coherence actually change my campaign brief?
It changes everything.
Because it means I stop trying to force the investor and the aspirational buyer to see the exact same unified message. I realize that forcing brand consistency on an ecosystem brand will actually destroy the interdependent tension that makes it valuable. I protect the different perception clouds instead of trying to merge them.
Exactly. If coherence dictates how your brand survives a crisis, we also need to look at how those perception clouds actually change over time. And sometimes we have to look at how the most powerful change comes from a brand doing absolutely nothing at all.
Okay, now this is where the language we use really matters. We use the term rebrand in the industry constantly, right? You launch a new logo, you put out a press release, and you assume the public just downloads the new mental software like an update.
Which is almost never what actually happens.
Right. But SBT uses the term recollapse. A rebrand implies a controlled redesign initiated by the company. A recollapse is what actually happens in the human brain. The observer's existing perception cloud is dismantled by new evidence, maybe a scandal or a radically new product line, and it has to be rebuilt from scratch.
But here's the catch. When the observer rebuilds that perception cloud in their mind, They drag all their pre-existing biases, memories, and priors along with them into the new structure.
They don't just forget everything that came before.
No. The company is not in full control of the outcome. A new perception will form, but it will be heavily colored by the ambient noise that already existed.
Recollapse is not a redesign. The old cloud dissolves whether you intend it to or not. And this brings us to one of the most fascinating concepts in this theory, the dark signal.
Yes.
It's like dark matter in physics. You can't see it, but its gravitational pull holds the whole galaxy together.
That's a great way to put it. In SBT, we call this structural absence. We mentioned Hermes earlier. Hermes makes billions of dollars, not just through the craftsmanship they promote, but through a highly engineered strategy of what they actively refuse to say or do.
The notorious waitlists. The absolute refusal to offer discounts or outlet stores, the geographic scarcity of their boutiques. They aren't running massive global ad campaigns shouting about how exclusive they are.
No, because if they did, it would ruin it.
Right. The absence of the product on the shelf is the signal. Your dark signal is a brand signal, too. Hermes built an empire on what it refuses to say.
Structural absence works by creating a gravitational well. The silence amplifies the few positive signals they do choose to release. But, and this is a big but, you can only pull this off if you strictly control your signal environment. And this introduces a crucial metric in the SBT framework, the design to ambient ratio, or the DA ratio.
Let's break that ratio down. So design signals are the elements the brand explicitly controls. The ad copy, the packaging, the store layout, the pricing.
Yes.
And ambient signals are the things the world says about the brand outside of their control. The Reddit reviews, the news coverage, the cultural memes, the unscripted behavior of executives on podcasts.
Exactly. Now, the framework identifies a Goldilocks zone for this ratio, which sits at roughly 55 to 65% design signals.
So you want to be slightly in control, but not entirely.
Right. If you control too much, say 80% of all signals associated with your brand are highly polished corporate communications, you lack authenticity. The public doesn't trust you because there's no organic ambient validation from the real world.
It feels too slick, too corporate. But if you control too little, you run into the Tesla problem.
Exactly. If you control too little, you are no longer managing your brand. Tesla's DA ratio sits at roughly 30% designed, 65% ambient.
Wow, 30-65.
Yeah. 30% of the brand is the actual car, the software, the showrooms. 65% is the cultural noise, the news cycle, the ambient chatter.
The environment is just swallowing them.
When your ratio is that inverted, your brand is being actively written by the environment. If you try to run a traditional marketing campaign with a 30-65 ratio, you're just shouting into a hurricane. No marketing campaign can save you if the ambient noise completely drowns out your design signals.
Wait, if I'm prepping for a brand audit, how do I actually measure this? If I feed my website copy into Claude or ChatGPT, how does the AI know what my cohorts actually perceive? Am I feeding it customer reviews and ambient noise too? Or just my design signals? I don't have a massive data science team to figure this out.
You don't need a data science team. That's the beauty of it.
Yeah.
SBT was entirely designed from the ground up for computational implementation.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because it treats brand as an eight-dimensional engineering problem, it is perfectly suited for frontier large language models. There is an open source prompt kit currently available on GitHub called the SBT framework.
So wait, I gather all my raw brand signals, the website copy and the PR, but also the ambient data, like the subreddit threads, the TikTok comments, and I feed all of it into the LLM using these structured prompts.
Yes. The pipeline takes you through the steps automatically. Step one, the LLM categorizes all of that mixed data across the eight dimensions. Step two, it maps the observer cohorts in your specific market, figuring out their spectral profiles based on the ambient data you provided. It identifies what they weigh heavily and what they ignore.
And step three is where it actually synthesizes the gaps. It takes the brand you intend to project, your design signals, and compares it against the perception cloud that your cohorts are actually forming from the ambient noise.
And the mathematical difference between those two things is what we call the rendering gap.
The rendering gap.
Right. It is the irreducible distance between what you specified as a brand manager and what the observer actually perceived in their mind. That rendering gap isn't just a fascinating piece of trivia. That gap is your strategic brief for the quarter.
Because it tells you what's broken.
Exactly. It tells you exactly which dimensions are failing, for which specific cohorts, and whether you have a signal consistency problem, an ambient noise problem, or a structural absence opportunity you aren't utilizing.
That is incredibly powerful. And I think the ultimate lesson here for CMOs and agency leads is this. The next time a client or a CEO asks you, is our brand healthy? The only honest answer you can give them anymore is, for which observer cohort?
Yep.
Because if you try to give them a single number, a 78 out of 100, you are mathematically hiding the truth. AI tools simply cannot operate on a single brand health number. They need high-dimensional data. You either decompose your brand into these 8 dimensions right now, or the AI is going to do it for you without your input, and you probably won't like the results.
If you want to go deeper on why dashboards hide structure, episode 9 shows the mathematics of why a single brand score is guaranteed to be wrong. If you work at the intersection of brand and operations, episode 4 connects the SBT framework to how your organization actually generates brand signals.
So, as we wrap up, I want you to think about your absolute favorite brand. Now ask yourself, are you loyal to the brand they actually designed, or are you just loyal to the perception cloud your own mind co-constructed out of their ambient noise? Because if it's the latter, they don't own your loyalty, your own biases do.